everybody, bienvenidos, bienvenidas. Welcome back to New Books in Latin American Studies. I'm Pamela Fuentes, the host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Dr. Ignacio Aguiló about his new book, The Darkening Nation, Race, Neoliberalism, and Crisis in Argentina. This book was published by the University of Wales Press this year as part of the Iberian and Latin American Studies series. Ignacio, welcome to the show.
Welcome, thank you, I'm really grateful that you are having me and you're giving me the chance to discuss my book with you, so yeah, thanks.
It's our pleasure to have you here. I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Okay, yeah, sure. I work at the University of Manchester. I'm a lecturer in Latin American Culture Studies, which I think will be the equivalent to an assistant professor in the US system. I've been working at Manchester for 5 years. This is my fifth year. I mainly deal with cultural production, but I have a particular interest in race, looking at the different ways in which race mediates and shapes social processes, focusing on literature, cinema, music, art. So I work across different forms of cultural production, but with a focus on racial issues. So far, I have been mainly working on Argentina, and now my latest project, about which I can and say a few words later on, it's about the Andean countries, particularly Ecuador. I come from Argentina, and that's why I had a particular interest in this country initially in my academic career. I studied sociology in Argentina, then I came to the UK to do my PhD, which was more on culture studies. So I usually navigate between these two disciplines. Not that they are very different, but obviously as a sociology, I didn't do much literary analysis or reading of cultural texts. That's something that I developed later on while I was doing my PhD. But I like this kind of mixed profile that I have, because in my research, yeah, I focus on cultural texts, but I always try to put them in context, and I like particularly to integrate more sociological data and approaches in my study of cultural products.
So all of your interests are very clear now, and I can see the relation with the book you wrote. But why did you decide to write The Darkening Nation? Why did you come up with the idea of exploring race and economic crisis in Argentina through the lens of a variety of cultural products?
Well, it stems partly of my own experiences being in Argentina during this crisis, 2001, 2002, but also the years before and the years immediately after were particularly dramatic. And I experienced them quite closely because I was there. I participated in the protests. I follow all the different political developments. They affect me directly. The context of crisis also of economic crisis also affected my own life, my everyday experiences. So that was an episode in my life. I never thought at that time I was studying sociology, and obviously I had not only a personal but also an academic interest in what was going on. But I never thought that could become a research project, because I didn't at that time had plans of becoming an academic. Later on, I moved to Britain and I to do a master's, and I was particularly interested in subcultures, youth subcultures, and I decided to do a little bit of research on cumbia villera, which is one of the cultural products I study in the book. It's a music subculture that emerged in the shanty towns, and I was particularly interested in reading this or analyzing this subculture from the point of view of the kind of the framework developed by Stuart Hall and other researchers in the UK and later on in the US. And one thing that I thought it was interesting about cumbia villera was how they put race at the center of its discourses and this and its style and its particular ethos. So well, this is something I started to get more to do further reading on this, and started to connect it with things that have to do with my own upbringing in Argentina and how race intervenes in everyday interaction, but also how it shapes certain forms of national identity. And then I went back to 2001, and I started to realize how important race had been in the ways in which people had dealt with the crisis, or how they had felt or lived the crisis. I started to ask questions: how can an economic crisis was experienced by people as a crisis? Well, obviously as a financial crisis, but as a crisis of national identity, and particularly the role of race in this crisis of national identity. And then I started to connect, to make certain connections between neoliberalism, crisis, and race in Argentina. And perhaps I need to provide a little bit of background on how racial discourses participate in the definition of national identity in Argentina. Like any other country, Argentina has its own narrative of exceptionality. All countries need to present themselves as being different from anybody else. Not that they are actually different, but they need that discourse in order to articulate a community, right? And in the case of Argentina, a very powerful discourse during the 20th century was that the Argentinians were mainly white. It was like it was a weird thing, like a white nation surrounded by these mixed race mestizo countries in Latin America. And this discourse of exceptionality linked to whiteness but was based on the notion that indigenous people, Afro-descendant people, mixed race people who live in Argentina in the 19th century had all more or less disappeared or were quite marginal, and that most of the people, the current inhabitants of Argentina, came from they were descendants of European migrants who had come at the turn of the 20th century. So there is these are the foundations for this course of difference of we are different because we are all white and we are all coming from these Europeans. And this discourse has been very successful in articulating national identity in Argentina, but also abroad it has been more or less successful, because I remember one quote by Octavio Paz. He says he says the Mexicans come from the Aztecs, the Peruvians from the Incas, and the Argentinians from the boats. So this idea of transatlantic immigration. And if I look at my own family history, well, this is true, because three of my four grandparents, they are Europeans. The other one is from the Middle East. So like any discourse, there is an element of a discourse of national identity, there is an element of truth. It's true that Argentina, a lot of Argentinians have European ancestry. And actually what I was able to find out is that if you take, if you look at that particular time of the big waves of migration from Europe to other parts of the world, and you look at settled societies like Australia, New Zealand, the United States, Canada, Argentina, well, and other Latin American countries, Argentina comes second after the United States in terms of the numbers of Europeans who migrated there. But there is a difference here. The United States already had a large population, so the receiving population was quite big. But in the case of Argentina, the population was smaller. So it's true that Europeans shape Argentinian culture at that particular time of nation building or national affirmation. And I find statistics that at one point, one out of three inhabitants of Buenos Aires, the capital, were Europeans. Around 3 million came. So it's true that Argentina has a big European component. But it's also true that black people, Afro descendants, and indigenous people, and mixed race people who were there before this big wave of immigration didn't necessarily disappear. What happened, and this is not something that I discovered, it's something that there is literature on the subject. What happened is that the state put forward a very ambitious program of whitening using the cultural apparatus of the state. So, for example, they invented particular categories in the census that were used to make indigenous people or black people officially whites. For example, they invented the category of a trigueño for black people. So a black person wasn't officially black, was trigueño, and trigueño is a more ambiguous category. They recuperated the idea of criollo, which was present in colonial Spanish America, which basically in colonial Spanish America, the criollo was somebody born in the Americas, but who had a European ancestry. I mean, most of the time it was used for other people, but mainly the idea of the criollo was an American Spaniard, right? So they used the category of criollo in the late 19th century, early 20th century to classify indigenous people. No? So instead of writing down indigenous people, they would write criollo. And criollo had this ambiguity, right? Because it implies that there is a connection to whiteness there. And this is something that Oscar Chamosa, a historian who works in the States, has researched a lot. So they implemented different strategies in order to make this in a non-white population slowly disappear through the framework of different state classifications. And they put forward this notion that most Argentinians were actually coming from the boats. During this crucial period of national affirmation in the first decades of the 20th century, while all these non-white people were being whitened according to these different categories, and the state was claiming that whitening was almost complete, and actually they stopped measuring race in census because they say it was not necessary. I think in 1896, the director of the National Census in Argentina says, well, we are not going to measure race anymore because everybody shares the same racial identity. So this helped establish a system of racial domination that continues throughout the 20th century and continues today, in the sense that everybody is white, so there is no racism, but officially. But in everyday reality, racism continues, and a lot of people who are non-white are constantly being marginalized, and they are subject to racism, etc. So there is this duplicity with racism in Argentina. It's something that nobody speaks about. It's something that non-white people have become invisible through this, through the action of the structure of the state, and also race is something that people don't talk about because why should you talk about it if everybody's white? Why should we talk about race? No, but it doesn't take much for a white Argentinian to realize the hypocrisy of that discourse that the person is defending. Because you go to the supermarket, or you encounter people who are, or you go to a working class neighborhood, and the people have darker skin, and phenotype is something that you kind of invisibilize. You can through the discourse of the state, but in everyday interaction, it's clear that not all Argentinians are white. And this system is partly, sometimes, it's not just imposed by the state, it's embraced by the large Argentine middle class who want to belong to a white country, because obviously that implies they are more advanced. And the notion of whiteness was used during the mid-20th century to claim that Argentina was also more advanced and had a larger middle class. It was slightly more than that, more developed than other Latin American nations. So it was embraced by the middle class, and at times it could be used by the same working class who were subject to racism, because it implied that they could participate in the national community. Mm? So and that partly, so you could say a working class person could say, well, I'm white, and through that feel part of the Argentine community. So the whiteness was successful in Argentina, but at a price, which is the fact that it became extremely ambiguous, because contrary to the United States, which I think the idea of who is white, who is black, is much more rigid. In Argentina, everybody could at times claim a little bit of whiteness, even if in everyday interaction, obviously working class people who had darker skin continued to experience racism and discrimination. So I think that's partly explains why Argentina never fully developed a racial movement, a racial political movement. Not that other Latin American countries managed to articulate a political movement based so only on race, or at least a mass political movement. But in Argentina, even Peronism, when Peronism emerges in the 1940s and Peronism becomes an articulator of the dark skin working class, who at that time were migrating en masse to the capital city to work in the industry, Peronism becomes an articulator, and clearly the anti-Peronist middle class, particularly in Buenos Aires, uses racial language to refer to these masses. No? There is this famous phrase, Cabecita Negra, which was used to describe the followers of Perón. So Cabecita Negra is clearly, there is an element of race there, but at the same time, it wasn't a proper racial category, because it wasn't supposed to be referring to a phenotype. It was about a lack of civility, lack of proper behavior, being a follower of Perón. So Perón was also very ambiguous. He never really embraced race as a central defining element of Peronist identity. And then the concept of cabecita negra, used by the middle class to discriminate the working class, slowly evolved into negro, which is still now used in Argentina, to refer to people of dark skin, not necessarily black. Most of them have indigenous ancestry, but it's used to in everyday interaction to refer to the working class. But still, it's claimed that it's not about race in a biological sense. Not that race is a biological thing, but at least in the sense in which it's understood in Anglo-American context, negro implies a social status and lack of behavior, of proper behavior, etc. So at one point, people started to say, "Well, in Argentina, there is no racist problem. The problem is, it has to do with social class." But it's not completely true, because race is still, as a social variable, as a social mediation in its own right, it's important in Argentinian society. And this duality of race, something that is defining people's lives and chances in Argentina, but at the same time is never spoken, is supposed to be not existent, it started to be challenged in the 1980s, 1990s. Indigenous people became more active. They became more mobilized. Afro-descendant groups slowly started to organize. Also, the impact of multiculturalism as a sort of an external discourse in the central countries started to impact in Argentina. And academics started also to be interested in the studying of Argentina's racial structure. So in the 90s, we see slowly academics, particularly from the United States, but then local academics start studying race in Argentina. It's not a coincidence that the first works are produced by academics in the United States, where race is everywhere, right?
Yeah.
And it's not a taboo to talk about race, while in Argentina, even now, but particularly in the 80s, 90s, well, why should we talk about race? There is no race here, no? it's a raceless country because everybody's white, which implies, of course, that whiteness is not a racial identity.
Yeah, but yeah. So, we see in your book that, yeah, that's a myth, and it becomes more complicated during the economic crisis in 2001 and 2002, when another big actor of your analysis, neoliberalism, is showing other faces in Argentina. Yeah. So for those that are not that familiar, what happened during that economic crisis?
Well, the 1990s is a moment, is a time in which I describe of heightened neoliberalism. Argentina became one of the most orthodox followers of the Washington Consensus. And during the 90s, there were a lot of neoliberal reforms. At the beginning, they were very successful. They were endorsed by the electorate because suddenly Argentina, the peso, the local currency, was pegged to the dollar, and people had access to foreign products, and people could travel, and so people became really excited about the possibility of consuming at that level. Also because Argentinians always had this kind of a complex, you know, of they were supposed to be, it was a nation destined to be great. One person said Argentinians were doomed to succeed, but that success had never really materialized. So neoliberalism, suddenly people think, well, we are part of the first world. And that was one of the slogans of the president at the time, Carlos Menem. Argentina is entrado en el primer mundo. Argentina now has entered the first world. You can is participating. Finally, is taking its place in the kind of the transnational network of developed nations and also white nations, no? So, but slowly things start getting more complicated, and recession starts, unemployment skyrockets, poverty starts increasing, and by 2001 the situation is extremely drastic. We are talking about 25% of people unemployed. A similar number of people employed in precarious jobs without any social security. Also, a lot of anger at the political establishment. And in December 2001, we have a series of protests, riots, food riots. The president declares a state of siege, and people take to the streets. There are a lot of demonstrations throughout the country. A lot of people die because of a very harsh repression. The president resigns. There is this odd thing. We have five presidents in a week until somebody finally takes over. The savings in the banks are frozen, so there are capital controls. People cannot withdraw their money. The situation is very severe. And in this context, produced by neoliberalism, this crisis of produced by neoliberalism, this is where I start seeing that people not only experience this as the economy is a disaster, but they also see how their aspirations of becoming first world citizens collapse, and they experience this crisis of national identity, but also a crisis of whiteness. And people start thinking, middle-class people who were the first ones to endorse this notion that Argentina, through neoliberalism, was entering the first world. These disenchanted people, they start thinking that the nation is becoming darker. The nation is darkening. Because it's becoming more Latin American. It's becoming poorer, more Latin American, and therefore darker. So we see, for example, the rise of racism target particularly at immigrants from other countries, Bolivians, Peruvians, Paraguayans. So these people coming from darker nations are coming here, stealing jobs, and they are threatening the national whiteness, which is something that is interesting because it's very similar to what is happening now in the United States and to an extent in Europe. Now, after when neoliberalism ends in crisis, people start embracing this nativist discourse, romanticizing a golden age that had to do with economic prosperity, but also cultural and racial homogeneity. And they start blaming everything on the darker immigrants from other parts of the world. So that started to happen in Argentina in 2001, 2002. So like trendsetters in terms of how to not react to a financial crisis. But what is interesting, I also started to identify a lot of cultural producers, more bohemian, more progressive, who use this crisis of whiteness to engage critically with this very same discourse that Argentinians were all white and descendants from Europeans. And they started to produce different forms of cultural production, in music, in literature, in art, in cinema, in which they show the racist nature of Argentinian society. They show a heterogeneous composition of the national population, and they basically expose that this discourse of racial homogeneity and whiteness that have been so central in articulating definitions of national identity in Argentina in the 20th century was basically an ideological construct. Ideological and a construct, but also something that needed to be destroyed, basically.
Yeah, so let's talk. You just paved the way to talk about all of these different cultural expressions. And as you said, from music, cinema, you have so many. I'm just going to focus on some of them to give our audience a little taste of all of the complexity of your analysis. And I would like to talk about one of your chapters titled Amerindians, Fashion Models, and Picketeers, where you analyze artwork that propose different approaches to race, mainly expressions that deal with indigenous populations in Argentina. And these different approaches have a different understanding or display of that. But I would like to focus on the fashion calendar. You mm-hmm. analyze a fashion calendar and also other forms of work art. I would like you to please describe the calendar for your audience, for our audience. And I would like also to hear a little bit more about the gender aspects related to it. When you talk about the, and I quote, racialized economy of desire that neoliberalism exacerbated, what are the elements that you were taking into account and what were your conclusions?
This particular calendar was a calendar produced by a very famous art photographer who also works with in the fashion industry called Gaby Herstein. She is basically every year she produces a calendar which is presented and as a sort of an art object to be collected. And there is a lot of press around it. And in 2001, the theme was indigenous cultures of Argentina. So each month included a photograph of a fashion model dressed as a particular indigenous culture of the Argentine territory. Many of them contemporary, but some of them extinct. And I thought it was interesting because the calendar, the narrative of the calendar, because they usually include a text, the narrative was that the calendar was, in a way, recuperating this non-whiteness that, as I said, had been invisibilized and excluded from the national community. The whole point was to show the richness of the different indigenous groups, but I thought there was an interesting contradiction in the sense that instead of photographing people from these indigenous groups, at least the ones that are still exist, she chose fashion models, you know, very famous fashion models, and the whole calendar is very sexualized because the models are shown with some of them showing their breasts and but most of them with very revealing clothes. So I tried to connect this to what had happened in Argentina in the 1990s. Something that happened in other parts of the world, but in Argentina had been in a way exacerbated by different factors. And this had to do with what I call the neoliberal economy of desire, the way in which bodies are sexualized and the parameters of beauty and handsomeness. And in Argentina, in the 1990s, the body became a central thing. The body, there was a big mediatization of society. So it is the moment in which the TV channels are privatized. We see the impact of cable television. Argentina becomes the country in Latin America with more subscribers to cable TV. And everybody's sexualizing everybody, you know, even politicians. Politicians start dating fashion models, male politicians. Female politicians are portrayed wearing revealing clothes in political magazines. And the President Menem is somebody is constantly making references to his different affairs, and he likes to point out that he has meetings with different female celebrities like Madonna or Claudia Schiffer. And he likes to make suggestions about things that might have happened. So I thought, well, the calendar is an interesting example of how the 1990s neoliberalism became, in this context of neoliberalism, the body became hypersexualized, but according to very specific parameters of beauty, which had to do with being white, being European or having European ancestry. And it's not a coincidence that Menem, who is short, and he comes from the interior of Argentina, he has Turkish background, so therefore he's not fully white, like to brag about his meetings with these female celebrities. Or well, Madonna is not very tall, but she's kind of white and blonde, and Xuxa and Claudia Schiffer. So this idea that he can have access to these white women, but also he's whitening himself by being with these white women. So I took that to the, and I started to analyze the calendar according to these different elements, and I saw how the calendar, of course, was extremely problematic in the sense that you had this white, very beautiful according to these parameters of beauty, very beautiful female fashion models, very sexualized, acting or posing as indigenous people. And I thought, well, this shows also how these discourses, these critical discourses of whiteness in Argentina, at the same time, had their own issues, because they were many of them were criticizing whiteness in Argentina and this and racism in Argentina, but through the embracement of another neoliberal product, which is a kind of postmodern multiculturalism that celebrates indigenous cultures or non-white cultures as long as they are not threatening to the state and to the markets. No, and this is what I don't remember the name of the author at the moment, but it's this has been described as the permitted Indian, the Indio permitido. No, so that showed an interesting dimension of many of these critical discourses that I have studied. Many are progressive in multiple ways, but many of them also reproduce certain aspects of neoliberalism that have to do with a very light understanding of multiculturalism. An understanding of multiculturalism as a structure that celebrates diversity as long as it's valuable for the market and as long as it's not a political, it doesn't pose any threats to the status quo. I think this calendar offers a good example of that. But I also found that there is a certain possibility of subverting the calendar through what could be described as a taste for kitsch. You know, when you see this very kind of, again, very according to the neoliberal economy of desire, very beautiful white models portray indigenous cultures, you instantly the photos are very kitsch, and if you this kitsch leads you to instantly see the discrepancy between the model and what the model is supposed to represent. And you clearly see that these people are not indigenous. So whiteness, the whiteness of the model, which it wouldn't be, it would be invisible in any other context, in the sense that in Argentina, because everybody's white, whiteness is naturalized and is taken for granted. But in this case, the whiteness comes to the fore because it's instantly catching your attention. Well, this is not an indigenous person. So whiteness becomes denaturalized. It becomes, it's exposed. So at least, I think unwittingly, the calendar ends up showing the ideological dimension of Argentina's discourse of race. And I think in that sense, you could say that the calendar could eventually perhaps allow for a more critical engagement with whiteness than the one that the author and the first reading of the calendar might suggest.
And let's talk about other bodies and other stories you have in your book. Mm. Your book is rich of engaging stories, and as I told you off the air, we could talk about them, but we don't have, sadly, as much time. But one of these really engaging stories is in chapter 4, where you study Bolivian immigrants as a racialized figure, as signifiers of non-whiteness in films. The opening paragraphs of this chapter describe an infamous soccer match. In 2009, Argentina lost against Bolivia 6-1. What was the cultural significance of that match and how it's related to the films you researched?
Well, that particular chapter deals with Bolivian immigrants because, as I said before, in this context of neoliberal crisis, there was a rise of racist anti-immigration discourses like the ones we are experiencing, we are seeing now in Europe and in the United States. And the Bolivian was hailed as the figure of most of complete otherness. So, there was racism against all immigrants, but the Bolivian was identified as kind of the most radical difference in relation with this ideal of Argentinian whiteness. And to the point that many dark-skinned working-class Argentinians started to be insulted by being called Bolivians. So Bolivians became this signifier of darkness, of non-whiteness, and allowed, maintaining the notion that this non-whiteness was coming from abroad. The Argentinians were all white, because you could say this you have a dark-skinned person in the street, that's a Bolivian, right? It's not Argentinian, no? So it was instrumental in this sense. And the match, it was a good excuse to kick off the discussion of the role of this racialization of Bolivians, how Bolivians who are... Bolivianness is a nationality. Why it became a race in the context of this neoliberal crisis in Argentina? The match is a good excuse because Argentinians went there to play against Bolivia, and they were trash. And you know, football is soccer is essential aspect of national identity, like, because it allows Argentinians to maintain these notion that they are a country destined to greatness, because. The socioeconomic indicators might not be great. Argentina is not a developed country, but we are a nation of great soccer, no? So we are very powerful in the soccer world. So this is one of the few things that allow Argentinians to maintain this notion that they are a nation destined to greatness. So when they lose 6-1 against the Bolivian team, it's not just a shame. Because of the scale of the defeat, it's a shame because they lost against Bolivia, a country that is not only weak in terms of soccer, but it's a country of non-white people. So this is summarizes in a way, or not summarizes, but illustrates the particular place of Bolivianness within Argentinian discourses of race. And this, I use this as an excuse to engage in the ways in which Bolivians were used to maintain the illusion of Argentina as a white country that was becoming darker because of this invasion of immigrants, and in a way canalized this racial anxieties of the Argentinian middle class that was experiencing unemployment and precarity, etc., etc.
And we opened this conversation, and you were talking about your interest in youth culture and music, and your closing chapter deals with youth music and subversion, I would say. You particularly explore cumbia villera. Who are villeros, and how did cumbia, or this particular genre, became an expression of resistance for young men and women?
Yeah. Cumbia villera is a variety of cumbia, which is originally a Colombian genre, but is popular throughout Latin America and also in other parts of the world. It's a variety of this particular kind of music that emerged in the shanty towns in the late 1990s, and in the early 2000s experienced a boom. It became quite commercially very successful, but also very controversial because the lyrics are about crime, about the celebration of drugs, of alcohol. They are very sexist, and women are put in a really kind of they are constantly denigrated in these lyrics. So it's a little bit like a gangster rap, if we want a quick analogy to a quick comparison with something that people might be more familiar with. So my position in this chapter is that this controversy, it generated a huge controversy to the point that it was censored by the state, the press, and it was demonized by the press and the media. The controversy around this genre, yeah, it has to do with the fact that they celebrated drug consumption and crime and sexism, but it did so by bringing all these different elements together and constructing an identity that is proudly non-white. So it brought all these different themes together and creating an ideal and a kind of an ideal of youth identity that was clearly defined whiteness, exposing how whiteness functions as an articulator of domination within Argentinian society. So I started to study the lyrics and the rhythms and the history of this genre, and I found something interesting. Most of these people, they create a very ambiguous notion of that, as I said, is intrinsically non-white. And most of the people in the shanty town, as I said before, they are mixed race, and most of them have indigenous phenotypes. But they created this ideal in which they started to compare themselves with black people or with a certain in transnational blackness that possessed all the stereotypes associated to blacks, that they are good with them, they are good at, they have rhythm, they are good at dancing, the stereotype of the black man as sexually powerful, etc. So I found it interesting how these people in an Argentinian shanty town, who were constantly being marginalized, and it's important to remember these are the people who like this music, they were young, growing out in a context in which there was no future. No, Argentina was in the process of a huge economic crisis. There was no job. Working class masculinities traditional working class masculinities were not valid anymore. So I find it interesting how they started to establish these imaginary connections with certain notions of blackness, of transnational blackness, that in a way were quite different from their reality, but nonetheless, through the music and through other forms of other patterns, they were connected. And so I look at that particular construction of an alternative form of working class masculinity that, as I said, proudly presented itself as non-white, that exposed the racialized nature of Argentinian society, that showed how in the context of a neoliberal crisis, race and racism was becoming more prominent. And at the same time, I look at the role of women within this
yes.
This framework. Cumbia Villera is extremely sexist, as I said before. The lyrics, I mean, there is no point in me quoting the lyrics, but they really portray women as the worst, as you call it. Women, there is this stereotype of the slag, of the woman who likes to have sex with everybody, and that is shown as something really bad, and the women are constantly being used by the narrative the characters in the lyrics, etc. So I draw on previous work that has not been done by me, but by anthropologists, on why women, despite these very sexy lyrics, still engage and enjoy Cumbia Villera. So I am quoting these works when I mentioned in my book that actually these women were re-signifying the stigma of being an easy woman, and instead demonstrating that what this idea of the easy woman was in fact a woman who was comfortable with her sexuality, who was becoming an agent of their sexuality, her sexuality, who was in a way becoming more independent, who wasn't following the established parameters of behavior and expectations associated to traditional working class women. And also, I found that this beyond lyrics, something that I also mentioned in that chapter, beyond lyrics, music is something that is rhythmical, it's kinetic. So Cumbia Villera, because of its particular characteristic, is very slow. It has a kind of a very draggy sound. It allowed people to dance alone, without necessarily dancing with a partner, without without complicated choreographies, without necessarily having to be in the dance hall with a man, as it's the case in traditional cumbia. So this allowed women to also be more independent in the nightclub, inside the nightclub at least, right? In the sense that they could dance alone or dance with girlfriends and do whatever they wanted. At least within the context of the dance hall, of course, there is a lot of sexism and misogyny and violence against women in Argentina. But from the point of view of dance, of the dancing, Cumbia Villera allowed this freedom, and that also explains why the women were still interested in this kind of music despite the sexist lyrics. So it's also about not just analyzing what a certain cultural producer says, but also how it's been received and appropriated and subverted as well. Yeah.
That's fascinating. And almost two decades after the crisis, what are your thoughts about race, neoliberalism, and cultural expressions in the current political context in Argentina?
For me, why I think this work is relevant is partly because it contributes to the scholarship on race in Argentina, which is something that academics are starting to look at, but as I say, still under discussed, and particularly focus on race in the context of a crisis, which is something that few people have done. And it also offers some perspectives to understand what happened afterwards. You know, in the aftermath of the crisis, when the situation became more normal, it became normalized, we have the government of the Kirchners. And the Kirchners, in a way, channelized many of these claims for a more inclusive notion of the nation that was the result of the 2001-2002 crisis. No? So if you look at many of the policies that the Kirchner couple carried out, at least in cultural terms, is about a shifting from this notion of a white Argentina to an Argentina that celebrates its ethnic and cultural diversity. And it's interesting to see how there is a big contrast between the 1920 celebration of the centenary of Argentina's independence and the 2010, which is the bicentennial of Argentina independence. In 1910, it's all about celebrating Argentina's links and relations with European countries. And in 2001, it's the opposite. It's about celebrating immigrants' communities, Afro descendants, indigenous cultures, and there are many cultural events in which we see a shift towards, as I say, a more heterogeneous understanding of Argentina, which, as I say, is the legacy of the crisis, also the legacy of multiculturalism as a discourse that is in a way is present in many countries. So for me, the work is relevant because it shows that one of the more long-lasting consequences of the crisis was at the level of national identity and cultural identities. A cultural identity, the way which Argentinians see themselves. At the same time, there are a lot of black and whites in the way in which the Kirchners dealt with racial issues, because they continued with extractive industries that put a lot of pressure on indigenous communities, mining, agribusiness, oil. So it's a Janus phase when there's this duality to the Kirchners. They were complicit many times in the harassment of indigenous communities and the violation of their rights, which are part of the constitution. But I thought it was interesting, at least from the cultural point of view, that they were echoing these claims from certain sectors of society to revise the way the Argentina's racial identity. What is happening now, I think, is in the context of a conservative reaction embodied by the figure of President Macri. I think, although Macri is trying to go back to certain ideas that can be characterized as pre-crisis, and is trying to sort of turn the clock back in certain areas, for example, human rights. He started to doubt about the number of people disappeared during the dictatorship. So there is an attempt to recuperate certain conservative discourses that were quite established in Argentina. I think there is no way in which he can go back to this notion that Argentina is intrinsically white, because I don't think social movements are going to allow him to do that. Nonetheless, he is accelerating or strengthening many measures that were in place before. A Mapuche activist was killed a few months ago, and another person who was he was killed by the police who were repressing a protest in Patagonia. Another person, Santiago Maldonado, was also, he died in very devious circumstances, also while he participated in a protest by Mapuches. Macri has also changed the immigration laws that Kirchner had put forward, which was much more inclusive than the one we have now. So there is a return to certain racist discourses, but I don't think I don't think that this is necessarily a complete return to this notion of this Argentinian whiteness as a central pillar of a national identity. But nonetheless, it's important that social movements keep the pressure, artists as well, and my book shows how the role of artists here, to put pressure in order to increase the visibility and the role of non-white people in Argentina, and to continue strengthening the discourse that Argentina is a heterogeneous country. I think also the book offers some interesting ideas to anybody who is following what's happening in many Anglo in the US and in Europe, in the sense that we have a disenchantment with neoliberalism, with the idea of cosmopolitanism as neoliberalism. The idea of cosmopolitanism that neoliberalism had put forward, the notion that, well, we are all multicultural societies. Again, a very mild notion of multiculturalism, but still a notion of multiculturalism. And they are embracing nativist and racist discourses. And there is a widespread preocupation regarding the possible darkening of the nation in Britain, in the US, in other parts of the world. So I think the book can also be useful, because it shows that many processes that are taking place now here I'm in Britain, but also in other parts of the world, were already taking place in Argentina.
Yeah, no, definitely. I couldn't agree more. When reading, we might think of Argentina and all of these exceptions that you said, like, well, they are not such. I think that's one of the richness of your book. Like, this book can talk to different audiences because those consequences of neoliberalism are taking place in this globalized world everywhere.
Yeah.
And migrants and figures and bodies are becoming figures of acceptance or rejection. So I think that's really, really interesting. And of course, we will stay tuned to what happened in Argentina and to what happens in your research agenda. What are your next projects? Are you working on something now?
Yeah, at the moment I'm starting a new research project that has to do with popular culture in the Andean countries, particularly with certain with the impact of digital technology in these countries and how they allow indigenous people to negotiate their place not only within the national community but also in a globalized world. I mean, there are a lot of research on the uses of digital technology by indigenous political movements and social movements, but I'm trying to sort of take a different path because I'm researching on things that are quite from a political point of view, they are quite mild or even completely apolitical. Certain singers and certain artists and musicians who have produced very kitsch videos on YouTube and the different receptions of these videos and how a kitsch can be used as a category that allows understanding the hybrid nature of these cultural productions in a world that is increasingly, or in a Latin America that is increasingly being transformed by the impact of digital technologies. So it's basically revising this discussion about the hybrid nature of, or the heterogeneous nature of Latin American societies, by focusing on how digital technology has impacted this and how it's being used by these indigenous people who are not necessarily embracing the discourse of identity politics to put forward an alternative way of being indigenous in Latin America.
That sounds like a great project, Ignacio. Okay. And I want to thank you for being on the show today. It was a pleasure. I really enjoyed it. Take care.
Thank you very much to you for your time and for having me and for the questions. And I hope it made sense, all the things I said.
It does make sense. Thank you very much. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.